Thank you. Greet you all in the name of our Savior, Jesus Christ, this evening. And I welcome you here, all those on live stream. Happy Veterans Day to all you veterans. I thank you all for your sacrifice. Thank you all for your service. It's much appreciated. Give me one moment to get set up here. So I have a start over. Our brother this morning talked about time and how we as people and as Christians, we need to use our time wisely. You know, it's time that we, as people, put value on. And so time has value. And if our time is taken from us, and we tend to have issues with that, do we not? So I'll ask you this question. You know, who here likes to spend their time suffering? Show of hands. Who likes to suffer? No one. No, not a single hand. All right, let me ask you this. Who here has spent time suffering? There's got to be more than that. Come on. You've never had a financial, physical, emotional, spiritual problem that you've had to deal with? I'm sure we can all figure out something somewhere along our lives where we've spent time suffering. You know, and so question is, you know, is this suffering, is it worth it? Well, what do I mean by suffering? You know, I think I can divide it up into two different groups. We have a suffering that we can all, I don't know, maybe agree on, but maybe we can all understand. Or we can see how a suffering would take place. You know, let's just pretend, for instance, a rattlesnake was up here on the stage. And I know rattlesnakes are poisonous. Now, if I walk over to that rattlesnake and it starts rattling at me, what is he doing? He's giving me a warning, is he not? And if I don't heed that warning and I antagonize that snake and I get bit, I'm going to suffer, am I not? But we can all agree it was an avoidable suffering, and that if my actions had been different, if I had heeded the warnings, and if I had gone with the knowledge that I had, I could have avoided that suffering. And so that's a kind of a, I'm going to say a, that's a justifiable suffering. I could have avoided that. I could have dodged that one, right? Same thing if I go out and I steal from people and I rob and the police catch up with me and I go to the court and they sentence me to, you know, 15 to 25 years and I'm sitting in jail and I'm suffering because I lost my freedom. You know, can we all agree that my actions led me there? And that is probably a justifiable suffering in most of our eyes, right? That we can see what led to that. And so there are times and places where we know it's suffering is an acceptable form, right? We intentionally put people in jail because it's not pleasant. You know, it's a big boy's time out. You're not supposed to do that. So, you know, any kind of poor decision-making process that results in any kind of a penalty, we can agree that, hey, had you done that better, had you not done that, you know, you would not have brought this suffering on yourself. You know, but what about what I would call unjust suffering? Has anyone ever had a cancer in their family? No. Has anyone ever had disease, poor health, poor genetics? Has anyone ever had those things? Did we ask for those things? No. Has anyone ever been a victim of a crime, had something stolen from them? Victim of abuse? Victim of happenstance? You just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. You didn't do anything wrong at all. You know, those are the kinds of things that we really struggle with. We spend time suffering, but it's the kind of suffering which happens as a result of things outside our control. You know, that's one of the things that atheists really attack, you know. Like our brother has given an apologetics course or some classes on it, and our brother Adam in Sunday school, our brother Joel on some Wednesday nights, you know, and I too have been researching some of these things. That's really one of the main attacks. If there's a good God, how can he allow suffering? How is it possible that he allows it? So why does suffering exist? None of us want it in any form, but yet we've all spent time doing it. You know, I'm going to give you a philosophical answer to this question, you know, why suffering exists. Now, to preface this, if someone is going through a trial, if someone's lost a child, know, they don't need to hear a philosophical answer. So if this, don't take this and use it for people who have just gone through a traumatic event. This is not for that, all right? They need charity. They need love. That's what they need. They don't need the philosophical answer at that point in time. But that's one of the things atheists will bring up. Their children, they get cancer. How would a good God allow that? And the answer is because God cannot create what is impossible. Have you ever heard of a one-ended stick? Is it possible to have a one-ended stick? No, it's impossible. Therefore, it is. And because you're sitting in the shade of a tree, does that mean that the sun does not exist? You see, you can't have one without the other. And I find it amazing when I was doing my studies for this sermon, you know, this question was answered a long time ago. And an explanation was given. If you go into 2 Nephi, in the first chapter, you know, Lehi is giving this exhortation. He understands, you know, his time on earth is coming to a close. And he gathers his family in and he starts giving them the last of his patriarchal advice and his blessing to his family and his children. I'm going to take a small section of that. 2 Nephi in the first chapter. I'm going to start in verse 81. For it must needs be that there is an opposition in all things. If not so, my firstborn in the wilderness, righteousness could not be brought to pass, neither wickedness, neither holiness, nor misery, neither good, nor bad. Wherefore, all things must needs be a compound in one. Wherefore, if it should be one body, it must needs remain as dead, having no life, neither death, nor corruption, nor incorruption, happiness, nor misery, neither sense, nor insensibility. Wherefore, it must needs have been created for a thing of naught. He's telling us, if there is no good and there is no evil, then they can't exist. We are created for nothing. We are created for purposelessness if there isn't good and if there isn't evil. Wherefore, there would have been no purpose in the end of its creation. Wherefore, this thing must needs destroy the wisdom of God and his eternal purposes, and also the power and mercy and the justice of God. And if he shall say there is no law, he shall also say there is no sin. And if he shall say there is no sin, he shall also say there is no righteousness. And if there be no righteousness, there be no happiness. And if there be no happiness, if there be no righteousness nor happiness, there be no punishment, nor misery. And if these things are not, there is no God. And if there is no God, we are not. Neither the earth, for there could not have been. No creation of things, neither to act, nor be acted upon. Wherefore all things must have vanished away. And now, my sons, I speak unto you these things for your profit and learning. For there is a God, and he created all things, both the heavens and the earth, and all things that in them is, both things to act and things to be acted upon, and to bring about his eternal purposes in the end of man, after he had created our first parents, and the beasts in the field, and the fowls of the air, and fine all things which are created, it must needs be that there was an opposition. Even the forbidden fruit to the tree of life, the one being sweet and the other bitter. Wherefore the Lord gave unto man that he should act for himself. So he gives us this explanation of free will. You know, God is responsible for its creation. But because we have free will, we are responsible for what we do with it. And there is the answer to our atheists. That is why evil exists, because you cannot have good without evil. And even by their very question, look at that, that's wrong. By what standard? By what measure? How do you know that's crooked if you're claiming there's no straight? How can you make that claim? You're hijacking the very thing which you are saying doesn't exist. It's impossible. Your argument doesn't stand. There's no such thing as a one-ended stick, and the shadows prove that there is a sun. God made the standard by which we judge just and unjust, straight and crooked, good and evil. That is the philosophical answer. Really, that's the point of my whole sermon. I'd close up and be done, but I think it'd be kind of cheap of me to do that. So how does this apply? How do we use these things? You know, we all suffer. So I have an example. A story that I heard not too long ago. I was kind of trolling through the internet looking at these history videos, and I found this video series on a man named Yi-Sun Sin. I think that's how you say it. It's a Korean name. Anyone ever heard of that? Yi-Sun Sin? Okay, good. I'll tell you the story. Now, he's not a Christian guy, so why am I telling you this story? I'm asking you to bear with me on this. But, you know, I find virtues do not show preference to culture, to race, to religion, to politics, to nationality, or any other qualifier you can find. Everyone recognizes kindness. Everyone recognizes honor. Everyone recognizes justice. Everyone recognizes peace and love. And these are not restricted by anything. They transcend political ties, language. I may not be able to communicate directly, but I can communicate kindness to anyone on this planet. And so his story, well, it's not found in our Bible, but you know, all these things we can recognize. So first I kind of have to give you a history lesson a little bit about what's going on. Yi, we're going to call him Yi from now on, that's easier. Yi was born in the 16th century, if I'm not mistaken, in the latter part of the 16th century. He was born in Korea. Now, Korea, at this time, in 1592, had been in a state of peace for nearly 200 years. They had not fought any major wars or campaigns for 200 years, right? Their whole government was based on Confucianism, and that it was supposed to be a meritocracy. However, at this point, it had gotten rotten to the core. And so it was basic politics, right? Favors, connections, you know, self-serving interests. We all have seen that. We all know what that is. But theirs was especially bad. You know, and as a result, you know, then this relative peace, which they enjoyed, you know, the military, a career in the military was very much frowned upon. So if you were a noble birth, you know, your parents, would push you to the schools of Confucianism, and they would push you to the courts of the king, and they would, that's where you made your life. That's where you made, you know, the best of yourself was in that. So the military, you know, there was no point in having it in most people's eyes. You know, so all the best minds went to the courts of the king. You know, as a result of this too, you know, practices and tactics and technology, they weren't advanced. And so they had a very, very poor military, poor state. They had systems in place, but they neglected them. You know, they had a reserve system set up, but they hadn't taken down names in years. And so everything's pretty much in a kind of a shambles. They really used their military for police actions. You know, raiders that would come across the border, they would go fight raiders. Pirates on the oceans, they would come and fight pirates. You know, these guys are not there to dominate the country. They just come in to steal something and move, take off again. You know, so it's a different kind of mentality. Now, just across the sea there, some islands called Japan. At this point in history, Japan has been in 100 years of civil war. And they have been in constant war for 100 years with each other. It's the Warring States period in Japanese history. And so their entire economy, their entire government, their entire structure was all based on complete and total war. And they were all set up for it. Well, then there's a peace comes. You know, the last of the civil wars take place, you know. So what do you do when you have an entire army, an entire economy, an entire government all set up for war, and you're done fighting your brothers and sisters? Well, there's our cousins over there. Let's go fight them. So off they go on conquest. So that's kind of the stage is set. Now, we'll go back to Yi. Said he was a young boy, and he was enamored with the military life. He wanted to do this more than anything else. And he spent all his time in play. He would play in military combat, and as he was playing as a boy, as he grew older, he began to hone his skills. He built his own bows, fletched his own arrows, gained his skill on horses and everything he could do to better himself. You know, and then in the year 1572, he tests for the military. And so he's testing for an officer spot. And so he's standing and he's performing in front of a bunch of other officers in the military, and he's riding his horse. This is one of his tests he has to do. It was an equestrian test. And the horse throws him off. And he hits the ground very hard. And everyone there thinks that he's dead. And he manages to come to, and he looks down, and his leg is now in the shape it wasn't when he got on the horse. And so he drags himself over to a tree, rips off some branches, forms himself a splint, he gets back on his horse, and he finishes the test. And they fail him anyway, because he fell off his horse. So he fails that test, even though he showed great courage, you know, even though he was suffering. Well, 4 years later, he heals, comes back, and he passes the test this time. Now he's age 32, which in those days is probably kind of old to get started in a military career. Usually those, you start off in your 20s, I would imagine, and it's a very active thing, you know, shooting bows and riding horses, you know, it's a young man's kind of game, but he's a little bit older now. And so his superiors don't feel that he's going to amount to much. So they send him off to this worthless border town in the middle of nowhere. You know, and it's been neglected for years, and it's the place they send people they don't like. We don't think you're going to amount to much, so off you go. Little spot in the northern border. And that was his position. He gets there, and the fort is falling in on itself. The men aren't trained. So he's got his work cut out for him. And he takes this as an opportunity. He begins to drill his men, make repairs to the fort, and soon that section of the border was the safest there was. All the raiders didn't go there anymore because he was very effective at what he did. So what is the Korean hierarchy? His commanding officers, they look at this, and instead of seeing potential, they see a threat. So instead of promoting him, giving him more responsibility, putting him in charge of more to help you out protect the rest of the border, they trump up some charges on him, send him back to court. He's beaten, he's tortured, and he is demoted back to the lowest officer rank. Now, I would call that unjust suffering, would you not? You're doing your job, you're doing what you're supposed to do, and your reward is you go get imprisoned and beaten and demoted. But that's the entire Korean hierarchy at the time. It was just very corrupt. Everybody was looking out for themselves, and anybody that had merit or skill or ability was a threat to you if they were beneath you, so you had to get rid of them. So he gets out of jail and goes back to another fort. Same thing, dilapidated. And he does the same thing there. This time someone takes notice and said, hey, you know what? We're going to send you to the military academy. We're going to have you teach there. So he goes, all right, let's go. Goes to the military academy. He's only there for a very short time. And again, like the rest of Korean society, that academy was not there to learn the arts of war. It was there for people who had connections, and they can get their sons in there, and they can get a better connection in the military. So it was rampant with corruption and payoffs and bribes, and so he started stopping that. He started drilling them, and he started reprimanding these cadets. Well, he wasn't liked for that, so they kicked him out of there and demoted him back to, this time, an enlisted rank. So he's no longer even an officer. He got booted all the way down to an enlisted rank, all because he was doing the right thing. You know, and this is Yi's career. It goes on and on and on. He goes someplace and he does his best and he does the best job that he can and he gets sent back. He's sent back a total of, I think, two times at this period. Well, he's beaten nearly to death and imprisoned. He was one time kicked out of the army altogether. But he fortunately had a few friends in the court, and they were able to kind of bring him back. However, after several years of this, in 1588, he kind of decides, he's an enlisted soldier at this point. He's no longer an officer. So he comes from a family of status, and now he's serving as an enlisted soldier. And he requests retirement. He goes and asks, hey, can I retire? Can I take my pension and can I go live? Well, one of his friends in court had now become prime minister. So the Prime Minister is looking across the pond there to Japan. They have been sending emissaries back and forth in their political connections, and he can see, he's one of the very few who can see, hey, there's a war coming. And he looks at Yi and says, you know what, we're going to need guys like you. We're going to need people that can stand up and fight, because there's a war coming. No one else really recognizes this, but this Prime Minister, who's wise, he can see. So, between the years of 1587 and 1592, Japan, what they want to do is to say, hey, we've got this big economy, this big battle-hardened warriors and experienced generals. We want to go attack Japan, or we want to go attack China. China's the goal. However, Korea is much closer to Japan than China is. So it would make sense, hey, we need a base of operations that's across the pond. So they're trying to get permission from Korea to march their armies across Korea and into China. And they're telling Korea, hey, we're not going to bother you. We're going to go attack China. Well, the Koreans, they have a lot of cultural ties and a lot of economic ties to China, and they have a lot of treaties and things, and they're like, you know, that doesn't sound too good. We don't really want a foreign army marauding across our lands, and these guys we're hooked up with them pretty good, so we're going to say no. So for all these years, they're going through all these negotiations, and the Koreans are like, nope, we don't want to let you guys march. So, going back to the Prime Minister and Yi, he takes Yi and he assigns him to a naval post. And this is something Yi has never done before in his life. He's never sailed a ship. He's never commanded a ship. He's not knew nothing about naval combat. So he assigns him to this naval station. And then the Prime Minister ensures that he gets promoted up the ranks relatively quickly, because he knows Yi's character. He knows what he's capable of. He knows what he can do. And Yi starts working, drilling his men, fixing their fleet, building more boats. Well, then in 1592, Japan says, we're done. And here we come. So they land 178,000 troops on Korean soil, uncontested. The Koreans at that point, they just don't see what's happening. Even as the fleets are coming over the horizon, and all their watchmen are saying, hey, there's a bunch of Japanese ships coming in. They're like, you know what, it's probably just a trade envoy. They're probably coming to say sorry. And it wasn't until the troops landed on the ground, on their shores, they're like, oh, this is bad. By then it was too late, right? They'd already landed. Not only that, once they landed, the Korean Navy that was on that section there, they panic. And so they don't want Japan to get their boats. So they scuttle 100 of their warships before they even fire a shot, before they even fight a battle. 100 warships sunk. So what happens now? Well, Japan begins its march. And within 2 months, they had swept aside the entire Korean army. They'd taken control of the capital, and they'd pushed the Korean government all the way up to the border of China. There's just a smidgen bit of land left that's called Korea. It's now occupied by Japan. And that's where they are. At this time, Yi, we'll call him Admiral Yi now, he's got 45 ships at his disposal. The Japanese have 1,700. Okay, for you math geeks out there, that's a ratio of 37 to 1. And Yi has never commanded a battle at sea in his life. Almost all the land in the entire Korean peninsula is completely occupied by Japanese troops. So there's virtually no army left at this point to defend anything on the homeland. What do you do? He can't control anything on land. He can only control his 45 ships that he's got. He's also got no support from his government because they're scrambling to get the army back together. Mind you, the government that tortured him and beat him. What do you do? Well, Yi did what he always did. He controlled what he could. He prepared his troops, he drilled his troops, and he exploited some of the weaknesses in the Japanese fleet. So he had two things kind of going for him. One, because Japan had been working on a land war, they completely neglected their navy. So their naval tactics were basically bring your ship up to somebody else's ship, board that ship, and then fight a land war. That's what their idea of naval combat was. Whereas the Koreans, They were used to chasing pirates. Pirate ships were faster, and they couldn't catch them, so they never did the hand-to-hand combat, so they had to develop cannons. When they developed these cannons, they were much larger, much bigger, and they had to develop boats that could carry them. So their boats were bigger, better, well-armed, as opposed to the Japanese boats. So he had that going for him, but that was about it. He still got 45 ships to 1,700. And also, as all the Japanese are ravaging the countryside, and all these displaced civilians are coming, so he takes them in. He puts them to work, makes his own production facilities, starts building more boats, starts a research facility, too, to research how to do things better. I mean, he's an amazing guy. He had nothing going for him, but he took what he had, and he used it. He gains the trust of the civilians and the sailors, and then he marches forth. And in 1592, he embarks on four campaigns against the Japanese. His first is at the harbor of Okpo. And he shows up to Okpo, and the Japanese are off their boats, and they are pillaging and murdering everyone in that town. And at that point is really when his resolve became very hardened, because he saw his countrymen being slaughtered, stealing their stuff, his Japanese men just coming in, just razing the town, burning everything they had. So he goes to work. He begins to fight battles against the Japanese. You know, and he's outnumbered every time. So he knows he can't fight them the way they fight. So he uses the best he can. He outmaneuvers them. In that Battle of Okpo, he sunk, I think it was 43 ships that he sunk. And he didn't lose a single ship. He had one sailor injured, and that was it. The next campaign, he goes to the harbor called Seishon. He goes there, does the same thing, fights the Japanese, catches them in the harbor, destroys their boats, destroys numerous other boats. In that battle, he comes back from the battle, and he's debriefing all of his commanders. He takes off his armor, takes out a knife, and he cuts a bullet out of his shoulder, throws the bullet down, and he keeps doing a debrief. I mean, this is one tough guy. And his commanders are just kind of shocked. They couldn't believe this, you know? And he didn't let anyone know during the battle that he'd been shot. He didn't want morale to go down. So he suffered with a wound in his shoulder for the whole battle. He didn't let anyone know, knowing that that would affect the morale of his men. So there's a couple more campaigns that he goes on. But the results of these campaigns, because he is just, every time he's outnumbered and every time he outmaneuvers and outfights the Japanese, and every time he never loses a single ship in his fleet, not one. And so because he has now effectively cut off their supply line, the Japanese army, which had pushed all the way up to the border, doesn't have supplies coming in, doesn't have reinforcements coming in, because the seaways are cut off. And he effectively stops that army from marching through. And then the commander of the Japanese forces tells everybody, you know, he's the number one priority. You got to go get him. And so, I mean, he's having his way, because he's studying all the naval charts that he can, studying how to do better tactics, and he forms better tactics, and each battle he's getting better and destroying more boats and still not losing a single ship. So, four campaigns, he never loses a ship. Japanese are like, hey, we got to get this guy. So the Japanese set up a double agent. They send him to the Korean court, and he tells them, hey, this place, this time, there's going to be this huge convoy of unarmed ships. It'd be nice if Admiral Yi was there to stop it. And they believe him. So they take that information, they pass it on, they order Yi, hey, go get this convoy that's coming. It's going to be an easy target. It's going to stop more troops than this. And Yi looks at it and goes, I don't think so. That's a bad idea. And so what do? The general that has effectively stopped, or the admiral that has effectively stopped the entire invasion, they give him a title, do they give him a medal? Nope. Another superior commander takes advantage of the situation, says you defied a direct order, has him arrested, tortured, demoted, sends him back to the army as an enlisted man. That naval commander who wanted his spot was jealous. He says, I'll follow the order. His fleet is now numbered 166 ships. He's built up over time. So he takes this fleet, which Yi built, 166 ships, and he drives headlong into the ambush and loses massively. Massive loss of life for the Koreans, massive loss of their ships. At the end of the day, out of the 166 ships that they had sent in that battle, there are 12 left. It consists of the entire Korean Navy at that time. They are demoralized and defeated. So then they kind of realize, oops, that was a bad thing. So they call Yi back up. Hey, we're going to give you back your rank. And you're back in charge of the Navy. Those 12 ships. Sorry. And so he gets back to the ships. And in the meantime, the Korean court says, you know what? This is a war. This is a lost cause. We're going to disband the Navy. So they give Yi another order. Take your sailors and go join the army. That's the best course of action. And Yi responds with this. This humble subject still has 12 ships. However small the number may be, I solemnly swear I'll be able to defend the sea if I prepare myself for death to resist the enemy. So they see his resolve, and they allow him to take over the Navy. Now, he's not suicidal. He completely understands he is absolutely outnumbered, he's got no supplies to speak of, hardly at all. But he takes these 12 ships, and he studies naval charts. He studies for weeks all these naval charts, looking at naval charts. He chooses a battleground. It's called the Roaring Straits. Now, the Roaring Straits are this small, thin channel that are in the southern Korean peninsula there. And they're called the Roaring Straits because they're quite dangerous. It had this odd property where the tides change direction every 3 hours, which is uncommon. Usually it's tides go in and out twice a day. Well, in this particular spot, the tides change place. Every 3 hours, they reverse for whatever reason. So he knows this. So he picks this spot. Well, the Japanese get wind of where he's at. And they send 133 warships to his 12. Again, he's outnumbered. And this time, most of his experienced sailors and commanders are now gone. He's got these 12 ships left. So he goes in, and in the strait, he begins to make this battle. And the rest of his fleet, his 11 ships, are behind him. Well, he's by himself making battle. So he swings back around and then makes a second pass. And on the second pass, all his men decide, well, I guess if he's doing it, we can do it too. So they all join in the battle. And the straits are so constrained in there, the Japanese ships can't maneuver. And so all their numbers are negated. So they can literally just pick away at the ones in the front. End of the day, 31 ships, Japanese, all go down to the bottom, and Yi loses none. So after this victory, all of a sudden, random ships are coming in. Ships that were thought to be lost, but they had managed to escape that horrific battle, that horrific defeat that they had at sea. So all of a sudden, he starts getting these new ships. And then, finally, the Chinese join in. They're like, oh, yeah, they're targeting us. Maybe we should help you guys out. So they send in some ships, and they send in some men. So now he's got 150 ships total. As he stops in ports along the way, you know, like I said, his government had nothing to give him. But he stops in ports, and all the citizens, they come out to meet him, and they just give him everything they've got. You can have our iron. You can have our cloth. You can have anything you need. We're just going to give it to you. Because they know that he's the one thing that's holding back them losing their country. They give it all to him. And then another stroke of luck happens. Japanese leader that's been pushing this war, he dies kind of unexpectedly. And so the remaining council kind of takes a vote and says, we've been at this for about 6 years now. I haven't really gotten anywhere. Who wants to stay and fight Korea? Nobody? Okay. Let's get out of there. So then they go and they attempt to negotiate this withdrawal with the Koreans. But again, after 6 years and 185,000 dead Korean citizens and soldiers, 50,000 captives taken back to Japan as slaves, Korea wasn't in a really forgiving mood. So they order Yi, hey, pursue the Japanese fleet. They're back at the harbor at Seishan. And again, Yi's got his 150 ships. And there are 500 of these Japanese ships. So once again, he uses his terrain, he uses his tactics to his advantage. He attacks them at night. And this battle is raging on most of the day. It goes on. It's a very long term, but it's the last battle. At this point, you know, the Japanese aren't fighting for honor. They're fighting because they want to get home. So they're desperate because they're on the land. The Chinese and Korean armies have surrounded them. And now on the sea, the Korean and Chinese navies have boxed them in. They're all right there in one spot. So they are desperate. So they're fighting to get out. So this fight continues, and it goes on and on and on. And Yi goes in and he to try and keep his men's morale up. There's a drum. At those days, they had big oars, you know, like a galley, and they were pushing these ships along, and they had a drum beat. They would beat this drum. As they would beat the drum, they would call out the cadence, and that's how fast they were supposed to go. So he got up there, and he started beating this drum to make sure his men could see that he was still in the battle. He was still wanting this to go on, give them support. Well, a stray bullet comes by, and it strikes him. But this time, it's a mortal wound, and he knows it. And he feels it. He feels himself dying, and he stops beating the drum, and he falls to the deck. And there are only two people up there where he's at and see him. It's his nephew and his son. And he tells them, "This battle is almost over, but do not tell the man of my death. Keep beating the drum." And so his son and his nephew conceal his body in his cabin. His nephew takes his armor, puts on the admiral's armor. His son goes back up, beats the drum. And for hours more, the battle goes on. No one knows that he's dead. And they keep going. And at the end of the day, 300 Japanese ships were sunk or captured. And again, not a single Korean or Chinese vessel was lost. So what's the point of this? It's kind of a long story. I just want to prove one point with this story. You know, did he suffer unjustly? Absolutely. But did it stop him from doing his duty? Did not. You know, just think for a minute. What would have happened if he'd given up? What would have happened if at the first chime, he got beaten and succumbed? It's like, I'm not going to take that rank of enlisted soldier. No, thank you. I quit. You know, history would have turned out very differently. What's more is his son would not have been given the example. His nephew would not have been given that example. And they would not have carried on that fight had it not been for his example. You know, the beauty of this is we have so many examples of our own, of the very same dedication to cause. Joseph in the Old Testament, he was given from God dreams telling him what was going to happen, telling him of the future. He takes these dreams and he gives them to his brothers and his fathers, and what do? They reprimand him for it. They hate him for it. Is it justified? No. Then what do? They bind him up, they throw him in a pit, they sell him off as a slave, go back and tell his father he's dead, rip up his coat, cover it in blood, cover their sin. Then he goes off to Egypt as a slave. You don't think you can get much worse than that. He goes into Potiphar's house. He does his best. Does what he can. What reward does he get? The lady of the house accuses him falsely. He's thrown in prison. Now, I was a slave, now I'm a prisoner. I can't imagine an Egyptian prison is a pleasant place to be. I'd imagine he probably had some suffering going on there. But he didn't quit. He did the best he could where he was. Interpreted the dreams. The two other prisoners said, "Please remember me." And then they forgot him. So he sat in prison. Here he is doing all God's work, doing everything God's asked him to do. Interpreting dreams. And he's sitting in a prison. But he didn't give up. He was soon vindicated. He was soon able to save his entire family. But you know, he ended up dying in Egypt. He never again saw Israel, his promised land. Never went back, to our knowledge. This doesn't say so. So he died, not knowing the full extent of what it is that he'd done. How about Nephi? When he came across, he was told, again, given dreams. The youngest, one of the youngest brothers, and yet what did his brothers do? They beat him, they bound him, they mocked him. all along the way. He suffered at the hands of his brothers. But did he quit? No, because of his suffering, we now have his record, because he was willing to suffer, willing to endure unjust suffering, only for doing what was right. We think of Abinadi. What did he do? He did what God told him. He was chased off, threatened to be murdered. God told him, go back. So he went back in disguise. And again, he was caught, put on trial for doing what was right. Did he give up? No. And what was his reward? They burned him. Did he suffer unjustly? He did. And he didn't get to see the fruits of that. He died. And it wasn't until one of those wicked prophets of Noah heard Abinadi, took his word to heart, and was able to take people away and save them. He never saw it, and yet he did it. You can imagine Paul sitting in his island prison, stuck there. And all he was able to do was write. Now we have it. Because he did what he could with what he had. And we enjoy the benefit of that. He probably couldn't see thousands of years in the future where we would benefit from his suffering. And there's scriptures are full of martyrs, men who suffered, women who suffered unjustly, but for a cause, a purpose, so that we can have their story. People they never saw, people they never knew, and yet they suffered for us. 1 Peter chapter 5. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, and he exalts you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary the devil is a roaring lion, walking about, seeking whom he may devour. Whom resist, steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same afflictions are accomplished in your brethren that are in the world. But the God of grace, the God of all grace, who hath called us into his eternal glory by Christ Jesus, after ye have suffered a while, make you perfect, establish, strengthen, settle you. To him be the glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen. You know, we have this higher calling. And that's what we must look to. Even though we're suffering, and then we may be caught in some emotional or physical struggle, some economic struggle that we have, we may not be able to see the benefits of it immediately. You may not be able to see the benefits of it ever. But it's for a cause. And it's for a purpose. And God remembers his own. Isaiah in the 40th chapter. So in the 28th verse. Hast thou not known? Hast thou not heard that the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary. There is no searching of his understanding. You know, we may not understand why it is that we suffer all the time, or why we see a loved one suffer. It may not be for us to understand in this time, in this place. It might be for something in the future. He giveth power to the faint, and to them that have no might, he increases strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But they that wait upon the Lord, those who are patient with the Lord, those who are humble before the Lord, shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. So I'm going to leave you with this question. Is there such a thing as unjust suffering? Thank you for your time.